Welcome to the Guitar Channel. I am super happy to welcome you a new incredible interview. I have on the other side of the Zoom connection the one and only Mike Campbell. Mike Campbell, how are you doing this morning in Los Angeles, California?
Thank you, Pierre. I'm doing really good. It's a beautiful day here in spite of the world stuff going on. I feel pretty good. Thank you.
Okay, that's good to know. We are going to talk about Reckless Abandon, the album you just released with the Dirty Knobs. But first, you have to tell me, what's the impact of the pandemic on your life as a musician?
What's the impact of the what?
What is the impact of the situation we have at the moment with the pandemic and everything on your life?
The pandemic.
Yeah.
Well, it sucks.
Yeah.
In a word, we're surviving. It's been a real on everyone, but I think it's just, you know, it's really hard on musicians and the crews and all the industry that are supported by touring. They're all out of work for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God there is a vaccine. I won't get into the politics so much, but yeah, it's affected us by isolating us. We can't really get, as a band, we can't get together and play right now, especially in LA where it's really spiking.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's staying home, not even going to the grocery store, and just trying to wait this thing out.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God for music, though.
Yeah. And how did you adapt to this situation? Did you write more music? Did you play more guitar?
Yes. Thank God I have a studio in my home where we recorded the album. So I come in here, like all through my life, I've spent a lot of time in my studio writing and recording. So that hasn't changed. I'm still writing a lot and, you know, putting songs together for the next couple of albums. And that kind of keeps me sane because I love to write. And I can come in here, and it's a state-of-the-art studio, so everything sounds really good. So it's fun.
Okay, that's great. I remember seeing you live with the Dirty Knobs. I think it was 2 years ago at the Winternam concert. And I even bought, I don't know if you can see this on the camera, but
a
bottleneck. Yeah, a slide. So I am super proud to have this with me. It's one of my prized possession. So I'm very happy about that.
We call her Pedal Girl.
Okay. Pedal Girl, okay, that's nice. And I remember I bought two, in fact, and I offered one to someone else, and there was two designs, right? A couple of designs, I think so.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't. Well, thank you.
Yeah, cool. It was great memory. It was the first time I was seeing you on stage, and it was a great, great concert. So let's talk about Reckless Abandon, which I think is really an awesome album. It was a blast to listen to it. And in fact, I listened to it many times because I prepared an interview I did with Jason Sine a couple of weeks ago. So, congratulations for releasing such a great album. Tell me, how was it composed?
Well, the songs were written over several years. Some of them were 4 or 5 years old, and some of them were written the week of the album. We made them up on the spot. And some of the older songs we'd actually played in front of an audience before, so I kind of knew that they would work, that people liked them and responded to them. Like I Still Love You, mm-hmm. that was one that had been around, and Loaded Gun. We had played those songs in concert, so they were pretty easy. And then some of the other songs like Fuck That Guy and Don't Knock the Boogie and Southern Boy, they kind of were more recent. So it was about half and half old and new.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a specific process when you write a song? I see that you have a guitar in your hand. So can you walk us through what was, I don't know, the initial idea for a song and how do you develop it?
That's a great question. Songwriting is such a mysterious and wonderful process.
Indeed, it is.
And I almost always have a guitar in my hand. And I listen to music. A lot of times I listen to old music that I grew up on. I get inspired by it again. It makes me want to write a song in a certain vein or another. And it's such a mysterious thing. It's almost, you don't want to talk about it too much because you'll give up the ghost. But it's mostly just a state of mind, you know, keeping your mind open and being able to, if the switch turns on, like, I don't know, I might start up in the morning, I might just hit a go. I might play some chords and I go, oh, that could be a song, and then I'm off and running.
Okay.
Sometimes it's a lyric will pop into your head, or sometimes I'll hear an old song, like by the Stones or the Beatles, and I'll hear a chord or something, and I'll go to the guitar and go, what is that, you know? And then I'll go, ooh, I can't do that, but I can do this. Maybe I can make my own song from that inspiration. So it happens in all kinds of different ways. You know, you just have to be open to follow it when it comes to you.
Mm-hmm. And when do you know that the song is ready to be recorded, that you hold something valuable enough to be recorded?
Well, usually when you first write it, you think it's the greatest thing that was ever written. And so then you try to, it's called New Song Euphoria. So you let it age for a while, and maybe you come back the next day or following day and go, oh, I can make that part better. And then eventually you get to, well, this sounds like I'd like to hear the band play it now, or else I'll go in the studio and make a demo. You just kind of work on it until it starts to sound, you know, worthy of recording, and then you record it and see if it holds up.
Mm-hmm. When I did the interview with Jason Sinead the other day, he told me that you worked on around 40 songs or something like that. So how did you pick the song that we have on the record?
Yeah, if I have a problem, it's writing too many songs. Of course, not all of them are good, but out of 20, there might be one good one. But what helped me on narrow down the songs was George Draculius, the producer. And he listened to all the stuff, and he would go, well, this is pretty good, but I don't think it fits with the band. And once we got kind of three or four songs in a certain kind of, like, the album feel, then we would pick the other songs that would go, that were in that vein, and not go in too many different directions stylistically.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really invaluable making the record sound like a cohesive unit, you know, so that's how it worked out.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the recording process. Was everything recorded live, or was it layered upon layer? How do you work usually?
No, it was, I wanted to make a live record. I didn't want to do layering. And the band, we've played together for, you know, a decade or more. So we were pretty tight. We could, you know, perform the songs relatively quick without too many mistakes. And I did not want to layer things. I did not want to overdub. You know, if something was really bad with a vocal went out of tune or a guitar string broke, we'd fix that. But if you listen to the record, you can hear us playing all at once from start to finish, you know, and you can hear the movement, you hear the dynamics, and you hear the humanity in it. And you don't get that kind of feel if you layer stuff. It's a different type of record, layering. And I wanted to make a live record that sounds like we sound when we play live. You know, just two guitars, bass, and drums. And that's how we approached it.
Mm-hmm. And when do you know, or how do you know that you have the right take and it's okay, the song is done and you need to move on to the next one?
Well, you ask your producer.
Okay.
Is that good enough?
Okay.
I mean, you can usually tell. You know, everybody will just like put out, if we get to a take and everybody just smiles and goes, oh, yeah, that was great. That usually means it was great. Or if somebody goes, I can do that better, we'll do it again.
You know? Mm-hmm.
But it's usually pretty obvious if it's working or not. But I would always go to George and say, should we do it again, or do you think we can make that work? You know, I trust him.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about how you recorded the guitar parts on the album. How did you work? How did you split the work between what you play and what Jason is playing on his parts?
Well, most of that is instinctual because we played together so long. I would show him this song and play what I play, and he has learned to fit in with me, sometimes make it sound like one guitar playing the same thing, or occasionally play against it to make a thing happen. And we didn't talk about it much. We just played the way we play, because I said we played together a lot over the years, and we've learned how to complement each other. And we did not spend time on the sounds. I had my guitar sound in one room, he had his little guitar sound in the bathroom. We closed the door, so they were kind of isolated. And then we had long chords, so the bass player and Jason sat right next to the drums with headphones on, so they were real tight together. Mm-hmm. I was in the other room behind the glass in the control room with a microphone where I could see them. And so it's really, we were really like physically close to each other as we played. And we did not spend much time on this. The sounds always sounded pretty good because the studio's tuned in. We just get in, okay, the sounds are fine. What do we do with the arrangement? You know, what we should we have a bridge here? Or should we double the chorus? You know, or whatever. We need an intro. We just worked on the music without worrying about the mics or anything.
Again, when I did the interview with Jason, he told me that you love to keep him on his toes and to surprise him, and you don't want to tell too much information or too early. So is that usually how you work with musicians, to try to push them to improvise?
Yeah, typically a musician is going to play best if he feels like he's playing what he wants to play.
Mm-hmm.
And if you give them too many rules, sometimes it can shut down their feeling. So, and Jason's like my little brother. You know, he looks up to me and I kind of look down to him. And I like to surprise him because he's very talented, but sometimes he has a tendency to overthink and play too many notes. So to counteract that, like on this song, Fuck That Guy, which is very simple, rhythm guitar, bass and drums, and a slide. I had him play the slide because I was singing and strumming rhythm. And he doesn't normally play slide that much. And I gave him a guitar, one of my guitars that he was unfamiliar with. And I said, here, just play really simple. And he played great. He played exactly what I would have wanted to play if I'd have done it. And it was because I kind of gave him, you know, a simple parameter, but then allowed him to do whatever he wanted to do. And that's how I work with him.
Mm-hmm. He told me the story that when you are playing on stage, you can go to him and say, okay, now play like Jimmy. And he turns to you and say, well, which Jimmy? Okay. Is that, again, your trick to surprise him?
Well, we got Jimmy Page,
yeah.
Jimmy Henry. We have a great relationship. And live, the Dirty Knobs Live is a lot of fun because there's a lot of that type of thing where we may throw in a song we haven't rehearsed that much, or we may change the arrangement. We might get to a place where I normally play lead, and to this next section, maybe I don't feel like playing it. I'll go, hey, Jason, play something.
Mm-hmm.
Or just look at him. He'll go, oh, okay. And he'll do it. And that's when he does his best stuff, is when I catch him off guard. You know?
Oh, okay.
And so there's a lot of spontaneity in the band, which I think you can hear on the record. You know, there's a lot of humor,
mm-hmm,
and interplay and surprising each other along the way.
Mm-hmm. And is it easier or is it more difficult as the years go by to find that magic spark when you play with other musicians?
Well, that's a good question. I think it gets easier because you're wiser. But it's kind of magic. You know, sometimes you just can't conjure it up. It comes when it wants to come. You know, you try to put the players in place and direct it the best you can, and just hope that something happens, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like fishing. You hope you catch a big fish with that hook. You know, sometimes it gets away.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, you are famous worldwide for your incredible guitar collection and so on. Tell us about the sexy tools you used on that record. Sorry.
Well, on Reckless Abandon, there's only a few guitars. It's mostly... I used my 59 Les Paul, which I'm lucky to have, and my old Fender Broadcaster, which I used on the first two Heartbreakers records, and actually a lot of Heartbreakers records. And Jason played a Stratocaster. I didn't really move around on guitars too much because we didn't want to mess around with the sound. We got a sound that sounded like live, and we kind of stuck with that. At the moment, I have over, you know, my 200 years in my life, I've acquired quite a few guitars. It's almost like a fetish. And I'm in the process right now, actually, of clearing out the warehouse and just selling some stuff, just because I don't have room for them anymore.
Okay.
I'm keeping the choice ones, you know, but I'm getting rid of some of the stuff that I hardly ever play.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a struggle to not buy more, but I think I'm done.
Okay. Do you know precisely how many guitars you have? Roughly?
Close to 200.
Okay.
200, I think, I'm guessing. But, you know, 100 of them are really choice, you know, valuable pieces of art. And the others are just good workhorses, you know, like White Falcons and Les Pauls and old Fenders. I like the older vintage guitars, which have just gone up in price over the years. So someday my kids will have them and they'll be able to cash them in.
Yeah. And did you work, so you just told us about the guitar you used on the record. Was that, again, conscious work you did with Jason to kind of find your place on the spectrum, to each have your spectrum area, or how did you work on that?
It was an instinct. I mean, typically I had this 59 Les Paul and I settled into that because I was able to get, and Jason would listen, and he figured out that his Stratocaster worked really good against it. It made a wide spectrum. And most of the time we went to that because we knew it would work. And occasionally we go, well, why don't we try something else here? Get a different tone, maybe, like on Buck, that guy with the, I gave him a Gretsch to play a slide on. Occasionally, or if we're doing acoustic guitars, we might pick a couple of different, a 12 or 6 string here and there on a couple of songs. But the go-to setup was Les Paul and Stratocaster.
Mm-hmm. What about amps? When I saw you play with the Dirty Knobs, when I bought this slide, you were playing, I think, with a couple of amps. Is that usually also how you record your tone on the album?
It is, yeah. On your record, I actually have this amp that I used on the whole record. It's made by Duesenberg, but it's patterned after a Fender Princeton from the 60s. And live, I have a Fender Princeton and also a Fender Tweed Deluxe. Those two amps, that's my sound for the last 20 years. Big room, little room that just works everywhere. And Jason does kind of the same thing. So we go down to relatively little amps, mm-hmm. and you put a microphone on it and make it sound big through the PA or through the console. But I don't like real loud amps at this age. I like to be able to talk over it if I have to.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mike, it was really awesome to be able to talk to you. As a word of conclusion, it is we are in the middle of January. What can I wish you for 2021? What are the next projects?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have dates. We had dates back in February when the album first was going to come out. Of course, everything got pushed back. So all those same dates are now being held for June.
Okay.
And
in the U.S., I suppose.
It's all over the bus to the U.S., yeah. But eventually we want to go to Europe. But we're holding those dates. Some of them we're opening for Chris Stapleton in bigger places. Mm. And then there's another section of the tour that we're playing in smaller places just with our audience where we're headlining. And they're all sold out and ready to go. And so we're hoping by some miracle, if I had to bet, I would say probably they'll have to push it back again because of the pandemic. I hope not. But we'll see how that plays out. So we're holding those dates as long as we can. And if we have to push them back, we push them back.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I'm going to work on another record. I'd like to have a second record done by then. So when we do go out, we can promote the record. Like this record came out with no tour.
Yeah.
And it would have been a lot nicer if we could have gone out and been playing the album while it's out. It would have helped the whole momentum.
Mm-hmm.
But it's done okay, actually, without the tour. But next record, I'd love to have a tour with it, to help raise the bar a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. As a conclusion, what would be the word of wisdom you would like to share with musicians? You have a beard, right? So you must be super wise. So what's your wisdom?
My wisdom?
Yeah.
Well, I've been around a long time, and my wisdom is really comes down to loving what I do. I mean, I seriously would do this if I got paid nothing because I just love music. I love being in a band. It's my happiest place to be. It's like close to heaven, when you're up there playing music and people are in the room with you and that interchange happens. It's just blissful. And I've always loved that. And I love being in a band, not being a solo artist. And I was in a band for 50 years, that did quite well.
Yeah.
And I just think if you're going to be a musician, you have to do it for the right reasons. And I never did it because I thought I could get rich. I did it because I just had to. I love it, in the deepest part of my heart. Music is my whole soul. And if you have that, you're going to be okay. Whether you make money or not, at least you've got the sources coming from the right place. You don't want to do this to become a rock star or rich. That's the wrong motivation. I think you'll probably hit a wall if you do that.
Mm-hmm.
But just do it if you love it, And that's the only wisdom I think I've learned over time is that, I never sold out for money. And I play what I want to play. Nobody tells me what to do with my music. I can do what I want. And that's how I live my life. And it's the only wisdom I can give you right now. Just work hard. Be patient. You know, I'm 70 years old now. I'm going to be 71. I don't feel old, thank God. You know, I feel actually pretty good physically. I hope I get to tour before I get too old to do it, but I think I've got a chance.
We hope to, yes.
So, you know, wisdom, I don't know, wisdom is just common sense a lot. You know, just do things for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Again, congratulations for releasing Reckless Abandon, which is a great album, and hopefully I will be able to see you playing somewhere in Paris or in Europe, not in the not-so-distant future. Thank you very much again for the time, Mike.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Pierre.
Bye-bye. Au revoir.
Bye. Au revoir.